Hello, good afternoon. Welcome, everyone. This afternoon, we're going to have this panel on the internet neutrality. My name is Pedro Paranaguá. I'm a law professor at the FGV School of Law in Rio de Janeiro, specializing on intellectual property and technology issues. Here at the panel, we have Mr. Marcelo Thompson. He used to be legal counsel for the Institute of Information Technology in the Brazilian presidency. And today he's a PhD candidate at the Oxford Internet Institute in the UK. Then you're going to have Professor Michael Geist, law professor at the University of Ottawa in Canada. Later we're going to have Ronaldo Lemos, professor and director of the Center for Technology and Society at the FGV School of Law in Rio de Janeiro. Later, we're going to have Mrs. Johanna Shelton from Google and former, used to work for Capitol Hill in the House of Representatives in the US. And finally, Claudio Prado from the Brazilian Ministry of Culture. So I won't take long and give the words, the floor to Marcelo Thompson.
Ladies and gentlemen, sorry for the delay. It is a pleasure here to be speaking in my hometown with colleagues, professors, and we are going to speak today about values. We are going to speak about neutrality. We are going to speak not only about network neutrality, we are going to speak more broadly of what a general principle of neutrality suddenly seems to mean in information age, different instances in which neutrality is called upon in the regulation of the information society, in the regulation of the information environment, in different areas of internet law and policy. So we are going to speak of the choices we are making for our information society, or perhaps to speak of the choices we risk not making for our information society. And here goes my take on our discussion. You may all know two stories, which I here use as metaphors. First, you may know the story of Dr. Faust, who in the pursuit of absolute knowledge accepted to surrender himself to the unknown. Second, you may know the story of Antonio, the merchant of Venice, who in the name of love, who in order to subsidize Bassanio in his trip to win the heart of Portia, put his own flesh, his own heart in mortgage when borrowing resources from the moneylender Shylock. I believe that in internet law and policy, we are also surrendering ourselves to the unknown, and that we are also committing ourselves to prices which we cannot pay. I believe that mistakenly we are doing so in name of very important values that we share or should be sharing, though to a large extent we are also being inconsistent with these very values we share by advocating a principle which prevents us from pursuing these values. The leading idea of my speech is that neutrality is not a wishful thinking principle for law and politics if it yet can be applied with consistency to any extent. I think I'll not use the PowerPoint because it's really not working. It's a pity. So let me first speak of the values we share or should be sharing. One of these values which I hold in the core of my most in-depth conviction is the value of access to technology and knowledge. So please do not understand this presentation, even if I condemn neutrality, as an advocacy in favor of those who in many fronts seek to restrict access to knowledge and decrease the vitality of the public domain. Access to technology and knowledge is essential to enable us to alter our lives, individually and collectively so. Another of the values, which I understand as essential in the information environment, is human personhood, is our ability to have our personhood acknowledged in the information environment, and also the implications that derive from that. What it takes to be a legal person is to be able to exercise your rights and duties, and also what personhood in the information environment, the manifestation of your personhood in the information environment, should also entail the protection of personal data, and that anonymity sometimes may be wishful thinking. So I'll here take this assumption that we're most of the times advocating two essential values in the information age, the value of a person and the value of access. But let us now get more concrete. My leading point in this presentation is that our commitment to these values, to the value of a person and to the value of knowledge, make our pursuit of a principle of neutrality a plain contradiction. That we ignore that we are inconsistent with these values when we advocate neutral laws and policies for the information age. To explain this, I'll note briefly three things. First, I'll argue that most of our regulatory challenges in internet law and policy surround the values just mentioned. Second, I'll claim that neutrality is a principle which is highly called upon in areas of technology regulation related to these values. Third, I will confront a principle of neutrality in technology law and policy with a general principle of political neutrality. The first point is one which I can make briefly. Well, you just have a naked man on the screen, so it's not really meaningful. The first point is one which I can make briefly, that these values are implicated in many instances of technology regulation can be easily recognizing by looking at the figure that should be there. It's a figure that would link authentication technologies to the value of human personhood, and that will link other dimensions of internet regulation, which would be internet communication, intellectual property, and filtering, in which I would understand more broadly search engines and also other tools of aggregating knowledge, such as Wikipedia. We would be understanding different regulatory areas in the information environment as linked to the value of access and to the value of personhood. My second point would be to portray the technological neutrality in each of these areas. The principle of technological neutrality appears generally as meaning that laws and policies should not be written so as to help or hinder the use or adoption of particular technologies. This is reflected, for instance, in authentication technology laws that do not prescribe or attach strong legal effects to particular technologies, laws that deal mostly with electronic signatures, for instance. This also happens to some extent in the privacy realm. The European directive on privacy in electronic communications demands, for instance, that no mandatory requirements for specific technical features are imposed. Also, the principle of technological neutrality is understood by many authors with regard to intellectual property as meaning that old intellectual property institutions should be extended to intellectual creations irrespectively of the means they are expressed in, that these creations are expressed in. So old general protection clauses are indiscriminately applied to a different technological realm, creating a dystopian system for the new information economy when we could actually be selling wine without bottles. Many do not concur with this extension allowed by neutrality, but these are likely to be amongst the many who do advocate a principle of neutrality in network communications, who do advocate the idea of network neutrality. What is interesting to know is here in network neutrality, the real debate starts to be unveiled. We're here speaking about values. We are not only talking about making the law more or less specific with regard to the technological infrastructure. We are talking about values. And here comes my third and last and most important point. Neutrality is indeed a matter of values. The principle of neutrality in law and politics is a deeply evaluative and political concept. It is an age-old doctrine in legal philosophy and political theory. It is the principle of neutrality is an anti-perfectionist principle. It advocates governmental restraint. Principle of restraint prevents government from pursuing valuable goals. They exclude action for valid, sound reasons for action. They enjoy the government to preserve a state of affairs, even where there are strong reasons to change these states of affairs. Minimalism is a principle of political restraint. Neutrality is another principle of political restraint. It advocates that governments should not choose between valid and invalid ideals of the good life. Neutrality is usually associated to liberalism, but this is not true. We have liberal authors that do not advocate a principle of neutrality. And on the other hand, we have liberal authors that do advocate a principle of neutrality. And on the other hand, we have liberal authors that do not advocate a principle of neutrality. Neutralists are criticized for many reasons. The most important for us being that they cannot explain why they do choose for some basic human goods while denying the intrinsic value of others. So this is a very important point. Rawls, John Rawls, for instance, commits himself to the value of a person. This, in his view, distinguishes his theory of justice from utilitarian theories that conflate all persons into a single one. But the important point, Rawls, however, denies the intrinsic value of knowledge. Neutralists tend to exclude the inherent value of certain things. They tend to give preference, they tend to hold in the core of their doctrines some particular values while denying other values. This is also reflected in legal theory. Legal philosophers, legal theorists that approach the philosophy of law, we have legal positivists that believe that they can capture law in a merely descriptive sense, that they can ignore values which are reflected by law. And we have other philosophers such as Ronald Dworkin who says that this is called what he names Archimedeanism. We believe that we can exclude values when dealing with legal matters, when dealing with regulation. And I'll close my speech in here just with a remark. We should have in mind that whenever we're talking about neutrality in any technological realm, any kind of regulation of different aspects of the information environment, we will be talking about values. We will be talking about choices that are about to be made by governments, values that should or should not be pursued. And a principle of neutrality just advocates that governments should ignore evaluative pursuits altogether. That governments should not pursue, famous neutralists advocate that governments shouldn't pursue, for instance, the value of knowledge. So I'm likely the odd person in this panel. I expect that most of the speakers will strongly advocate, for instance, a principle of neutrality, a principle of network neutrality, praise its values for fostering access to knowledge, why we need a neutral internet. And this keeps at the more theoretical level, but I hope that the following panelists will be able to bring this to a more concrete expression and make you perceive more in concrete the importance of understanding what neutrality really means in the information age.
Okay, thank you, Marcelo Thompson. Now we're going to the second panelist, Professor Michael Geist from the University of Ottawa.
Is this on? Okay. Well, thanks very much, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's a panel that's labeled as talking about human rights and neutrality, and I think when we talk about net neutrality-related issues, it's important to always remind ourselves that there's a core human rights component here. It's all, in many respects, much of this is all about freedom of expression and freedom of speech, and concerns that some of that might be curtailed, lest we not adhere to, I think, the value of neutrality as increasing number of people are talking about it. I'd like to talk about what is sometimes described as core neutrality. But before I talk about core network neutrality, sort of a bit of background to lead us there, because I think it's rather interesting. When the expectation at an event like this, an internet governance forum, would be that if you're going to talk about net neutrality, you'll talk about so-called traditional notions of net neutrality, internet service providers, by and large, treating like content and like applications in an equal fashion. But I think it's rather interesting that there is a real convergence, I think, between that notion of net neutrality and the internet governance related issues that were part of the WSIS process and then that have been part of the IGF and that we saw on display a little bit yesterday during the critical internet resources panel. So to show how that convergence is taking place, there's obviously the net neutrality side of things. And for those that are new to the debate, there are lots of different definitions of network neutrality, of course, but for many, virtually all would agree with, I think, the notion that there ought to be equal treatment of content and applications, i.e. that internet service providers not treat content and applications in a different or block certain kinds of content and applications. But certainly in North America, we have had incidents where that has occurred. In a content perspective in Canada, actually, one of our second largest telecom provider, TELUS, which blocked access to one website that it objected to on the grounds it was involved with a fight with its union, and this website contained stuff that it thought was damaging to some of its management employees who were not striking. In the process, they blocked access to more than 600 additional websites, all located on the same IP address. In the United States, there's the well-known case as well of Madison River blocking access now to voice, in that instance, to voice over IP, so blocking access to an application. So lots of examples are in a growing number, unfortunately, of examples where we might have that kind of blocking of access to content or applications. One of the issues that has attracted even more attention most recently under the notion of network neutrality is what's referred to often as traffic shaping, where ISPs allot or allocate less and less amount of content for particular kinds of applications, typically BitTorrent and the like. And that's something that in Canada we've had for some time. Rogers, our largest cable provider, has been engaged in traffic shaping for a number of years, and they now somewhat openly acknowledge that they in fact do that. And so that only a certain amount of the bandwidth that you pay for each month can be used for that particular application. You're an independent filmmaker who's using torrents as your mechanism for distribution. You often find that end users can't effectively access that because the amount of bandwidth that they can use to access it has been diminished so heavily. Same sort of situation arising, but frankly in some ways even more serious in the United States with Comcast. An issue that's attracted a lot of attention over the last couple of weeks, where they are also engaging in some of the shaping, but even doing more than that to disrupt the packets and the way in which they move, inject certain things into the network. And then there's, of course, often talk about charging to prioritize certain kinds of content on the internet. You've seen that in countries even outside of North America. The BBC, with its iPlayer, when it launched and giving people the ability to access BBC content through the internet, many of the broadband providers started talking about charging BBC for doing that. And you've seen the same sort of speculation, certainly in Canada and the United States, both markets where there's not a huge amount of competition from a consumer perspective for broadband connectivity, where there is talk about it's pay if you'd like to go on the really fast speeds and leave everybody else to the slow lane. So that's much of the talk around net neutrality. I think it's interesting that within an internet governance context, people have rarely talked about that internet governance debate as one about neutrality, but in many respects, I think that's precisely what it's been. When people have been debating for now a number of years about ICANN and the effectiveness of its structure and the possibility for some changes to that structure, they're in many respects talking about neutrality. They're talking about the ability to have confidence in those structures, to know that the structure itself will be broadly representative, neutral, in a sense, so that all views are heard. And so when we hear, as we heard yesterday, and we have heard, of course, for a number of years now, that there is concerns that in this sort of in this current framework, you've got one government that is seen as standing above others because it's got the ability to have stronger oversight mechanism, let's say, over ICANN. There are concerns as to whether that's truly a neutral approach within internet governance. The same goes for how the board has been populated, which started out as an attempt to ensure that it was neutral, broadly representative, by allowing at least half the board to be elected. That was gradually diminished from 9 members of the board to 5 members of the board to now no members of the board. And the debate around ICANN is one of whether or not you can put together a nominating committee that is itself neutral and broadly representative, such that they can then put forward members of the board that will be neutral and broadly representative. So ICANN itself has grappled, I think, with those same sorts of things. Now, what's interesting is there is, I think, a convergence between the network neutrality debate as well as the internet governance debate. And it's one that some people have referred to as keeping the core neutral, so keeping the neutrality within the core of the network. And this comes up in a number of different places, and I'll highlight them for you. It happens certainly in not just in an ICANN space, but also in a private sector space as well, areas where there may be in the future pressure on ICANN or other sorts of entities to act in a manner that is not neutral respect to the core. The SiteFinder service, for example, that VeriSign sought to launch a number of years ago, where for any domain name that didn't resolve, you'd go to a VeriSign-related page. That wild card raised a lot of concerns, and we have over the last number of weeks learned that a number of ISPs would like to replace what VeriSign had in mind with instead their own version of replacing an unresolved domain request. So Verizon has been one company that's been cited as having an interest in doing that, but I suspect it's not alone, and a number of people have raised other ISPs that for them they would love to have the ability of pointing users that are trying to access a particular page are unsuccessful in doing so to go to one of their own pages and populate it potentially with click-through advertising or other sorts of their own content and benefit from that, changing the way in which, for many people, the DNS has effectively functioned, at least in the way that they've seen it resolve from their browser. You also see things even that are occurring here. I noted down in the booth downstairs, where the booths are downstairs, where there are a number of people promoting a number of things, there's one group, CP80, which warns of the internet porndemic and a number of other ills related to pornography and the internet, whose suggestion, as far as I can tell, taking a look at their website and some of their recommendations, is to make changes directly at the root level, talking about getting the RIRs and others who are allocating out numbering and names to get more actively involved in blocking access to certain kinds of content. So there is certainly pressure on ICANN to get engaged in that, or I think there will be. Then there is ICANN itself. And certainly, I think the best known example of concerns around whether or not they keep the core neutral involves the allocation of new generic top-level domains, new GTLDs, and of course the long-running saga over the .xxx domain, which if you look at this from the perspective of remaining neutral, you take the view that it's ICANN's job to ensure that a proposed domain, proposed extension meets a certain set of criteria, and you leave questions about the sensitivity of some of the domains or even some of the sensitivity of the content that might use some of those extensions to, if anyone, national governments who can set some of their rules if they have some concerns, but you take the position that it is not ICANN's job to get into the content management business in the sense of saying we reject a particular extension because we are uncomfortable with the kind of content that is likely to be populated within that extension. Yeah, within .xxx, that was precisely, I think, in the view of many, of what happened within ICANN, where despite the fact that .xxx met many of the requisite requirements, the board struggled with many of the other pressures for it to become more of a content management agency, more of a content regulator, and not keep the core neutral in the sense of new generic top-level domains. That's the example that's frequently cited. I think there are others, though. I'd cite as another the UDRP, the Uniform Domain Name Dispute Resolution Policy. It's been in place for some time, and I've done a fair amount of research and been somewhat critical of it. The prime criticism that has emerged around the UDRP from myself and others has been about inadequacies with respect to the protection of free speech, of criticism websites, on the notion that there is nothing wrong in theory with ICANN establishing a policy to address domain name disputes that arise from time to time, but it is incumbent upon ICANN to ensure that it is neutral. Neutral in the sense that it doesn't prefer or prioritize one form of speech over another. And I think you can make the case, I think quite strongly actually in the case of the UDRP, that there are certain kinds of speech, particularly criticism speech, that will often be deprioritized and can vanish from the net, or at least the domain name itself can vanish from the net, under a policy that provides, I think, an inherent bias to remove some of those criticism domains where they are seen to interfere with a trademark holder's rights. So that net neutrality, in summary, net neutrality has been there, I think, now for a couple of years, focused largely, of course, on internet service providers and the way in which they treat the traffic that occurs on their network. I think that it's in a fora like this, in the internet governance fora, that we need to recognize that there is another component to this issue, one in which where we look at the core itself and realize that there is a need for neutrality there as well. Thanks.
Thank you, Professor Geist. Now we come to the third speaker, Professor Ronaldo Lemos, director from the Center for Technology and Society at the FGV School of Law in Rio, and also chairman of the iCommons.
Thank you. I'm going to speak about a different kind of net neutrality that has to do with legal net neutrality. And I'm going to use a Brazilian example, which can maybe feel as an interesting case for the same problems that might arise in other countries as well. So in January 2007, YouTube was blocked here in Brazil by a court order that was issued in the city of São Paulo. And the reason for the court to issue this injunction was that a video of a famous Brazilian model called Daniela Sicarelli was available on YouTube, and she was depicted in that video in a romantic encounter with her boyfriend in the beaches of Cadiz in Spain. So the entire website was mandated by the court in São Paulo to be blocked. So an order was issued to all the operators of the Brazilian backbones that the entire website be blocked because of that particular video. The reason for a court order to be issued like that in Brazil is that we are in 2007 and still we do not have a regulation made in Brazil about the liability of internet service providers or internet online service providers. So when you do not have the law regulating issues like that, basically the courts are free to judge based in what we call from the civil law tradition general principles of law. And as you know, people disagree about what the general principles of law are. And in some cases, a personal right of privacy can be balanced in the sense that the entire rights of the Brazilian population to access a particular website, in this case YouTube, are less important than this particular claim for privacy. So the point is, regulation is very important to take place in Brazil right now, especially to define what is the liability of online service providers and internet service providers. And finally, the discussion actually went through, and there are movements taking place in the Brazilian Congress and in the Brazilian Senate to approve laws regulating this kind of liabilities. But the bad news are that actually the regulation that is being proposed will be made throughout criminal law. This is a very interesting thing for the history of Brazil, because if we look back to the 19th century, the first copyright law in Brazil was actually the Criminal Code of 1828. So we have a tradition in Brazil of regulating complicated issues, complex issues, throughout criminal law. And we inherit this tradition from the 19th century, and now we are repeating that same history again in the year 2000s. So basically, if one looks at a proposal that is currently being analyzed by the Brazilian Congress to regulate the Brazilian internet from the standpoint of criminal law, you might find things like this. Number one, it's a very complex and extensive body of law that has been proposed to the Brazilian Congress. And the first thing that this project does, I'm basing my comments here on the first version of the project that was disseminated, is that it makes the idea of data equivalent to the idea of a physical thing for criminal purposes. This is a very interesting example of legal experimentation in Brazil, because I don't think this has happened anywhere else in the world. So this particular law says that a piece of data on the internet should be considered just like a physical thing. The consequences of that are unpredictable. For instance, you could apply the crime of stealing, which is only applied in Brazil to physical things, to data. Or also, you could have like court injunctions being issued requiring the seizure of data as if data were a physical thing. So for instance, considering that in the internet, a phone conversation becomes data, or for instance, a streaming or a chat becomes data, you could have the courts issuing an injunction in Brazil to apprehend, to seize a phone conversation that took place maybe 3 months ago or 4 months ago, if that phone conversation is stored somewhere. The second thing that this particular piece of law requires is that the internet service providers keep a technological apparatus, they keep like a technological infrastructure in order to monitor this data that have been flowing through their networks. It's not mandatory that all records be kept, like the law establishes when the records should be kept or not, but it does require that the networks build the capacity to basically monitor all the traffic that's going through their pipes. So that's the second thing that the law requires. And finally, and my last point about this particular piece of law that is being discussed, is that if you consider the North American Digital Millennium Copyright Act that has received some criticism because of the anti-circumvention provisions in which you can commit a criminal offense if you circumvent a technological protection measure that has been applied for a CD, a DVD, or a particular network. This particular project that has been proposed in Brazil can be considered as a DMCA plus, because it goes much beyond the DMCA in as much as it says that if you access a computer network, a device for communication, or any information system without the legitimate authorization of the owner of the network, when required, you are committing a criminal offense. So access itself is being made into a criminal offense. Unlike the DMCA, in which you have to actively circumvent the technological protection measure, in this case, if you violate the terms of service of a particular website, which does not authorize you to do some things in the website, you might be committing a criminal offense in Brazil. So my point is, to close my brief contribution to the discussion about net neutrality, we do have a homework to do in Brazil in regulating the Brazilian internet. But what we have to do is to build what we call a civil law regulation, not a criminal law. The internet is a very complex issue. It should not be regulated by criminal law in the first place without we having made our homework as a criminal law body of law. And the reason for that is innovation. I will close by asking you a question. Who would dare to create a Brazilian internet service provider or an online service provider in Brazil if you risk being sent to jail by provisions like that? So that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Ronaldo. Now the fourth panelist is Mrs. Johanna Shelton, Policy Counsel and Legislative Strategist at Google, with former experience at Capitol Hill House of Representatives in the US. Please have the floor.
Thank you. I'm glad I don't have to answer Ronaldo's question as to who would be crazy enough to do something like that. Let me just start by explaining why Google thinks that the net neutrality is absolutely, or the open internet is absolutely critical and crucial on a going forward basis to maintain and preserve the openness of the internet. a lot of people come to us and say, "You're Google, you'll be fine. Don't worry about it. You're big enough. You can negotiate your way out of anything." So let me just take a moment and explain what we see at risk with a non-neutral network. And the first is the point that Rinaldo was just ending on, which is that innovation. It is absolutely clear that there is less innovation when you need to ask permission before you can innovate. And so in a world where you don't have to ask permission, where you have open standards in which you can tinker and experiment and do the kinds of things that engineers around the world are doing at any day, that's the kind of environment that produces just an absolutely astonishing amount of content and applications and services. It could be two young students in a garage in Rio that design something really cool and want to reach the world. Well, imagine if they have to go to every single ISP in every single country and cut a deal before they are allowed to put that out for the world. That's a very scary proposition, and one that really denies a lot to societies and to all the individuals and to sort of the notion of the usefulness of a platform as remarkable as the internet. The second really important question and reason why we think neutrality in the network is so important is because of the investment incentives for the network itself. If there is an ability to create an artificial scarcity at some point in the network that you can charge to push people through, to prioritize and to move certain content ahead of other content, what is your incentive to keep expanding that network? You in some sense, as a provider that has something like that where they can determine who gets through the congested area, the more congestion, the more ability for them to charge more money. Where is the recognition on the consumer end of that the internet has always done since its origination, that we need to keep expanding the capacity as people in their garages in Rio or in the dorm rooms are creating more and more interesting applications, oftentimes involving high bandwidth, video games, those kinds of applications. Where is the incentive to actually expand that capacity more and more and more if you are able to stop it at a certain place and just charge more money to send people through? So those are real questions that Google has been looking at for a long time as we deal with this issue primarily in the US but also everywhere else. Just following on that point, we're not a company that just speaks this and that it's just rhetoric to us. We actually do put our money where our mouth is on this issue. Engineers have been creating things like Open Social, which is an open platform for development where people can take content across different social networks. We have just announced a really important open handset alliance with 34 other companies around the world to create an open platform on the mobile space, an operating system and an interface to allow people to design build upon a general open platform in the mobile area. And we gave this away for free. And so one of the situations that we face more in the US, I think, than in other places, is that we have a mobile environment that is very controlled by the network operators themselves. Devices are controlled by the network. Applications are, to a large extent, controlled by the network. The networks are not designed to be internet, to be like the internet and to be open and to be platforms where you can, if you have a creative idea and you want to get it to consumers when they have their mobile handset, right now there's some real barriers to actually being able to do that. So that's something that we wanted to help to try to fix, recognizing that there's no reason why these mobile devices can't be real computers in everybody's hand, and a lot of people that have cell phones don't necessarily have computers, and there's a whole wide environment and audience that we think would benefit from the ability to have a more internet-like mobile space. We also have been advocating the neutrality principles in places like the in the United States when we have new spectrum coming online and new ability to do more wireless broadband capabilities. We went before the FCC and advocated for four openness principles: open devices, open applications, open services, meaning you can acquire bandwidth and do wholesale arrangements, or if you're an entrepreneur with a good idea who comes along later and you don't have the, you didn't buy spectrum for billions of dollars from the government, you have the ability to actually use other spectrum and get your product through. And open networks, interconnection of the network, so that they can work to the best extent that they can. Now, the U.S. government didn't agree with all of those principles, but did agree with the open devices and open applications. And so that's a very important first step in terms of this new spectrum that comes available. And obviously, when you have a situation where there is new spectrum that comes available, there is no existing incumbent provider in that space. This is all a new, you know, people will be bidding on that spectrum. There's no existing business models that will face any kind of disruption in this environment. So we really encourage, as around the world, where there's more places for spectrum, to really have some conversations about what should be the principles that apply in terms of openness and those networks as we go forward. Obviously, I think the open internet is just crucial for harnessing the innovation and the economic development, and making more information accessible, which underlies the values that we've been talking about for the past few days here, freedom of expression, access to more information. With a neutral infrastructure, people can speak more. They can give voice to people that don't have a voice today. So we think it's very, very important for broadband providers and all network providers to respect the integrity of the internet's layered end-to-end architecture and to not interfere in that situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Johanna. It seems that the fifth panelist, Claudio Prado, has been just called by the Brazilian Minister of Culture. It's the reason why he's not here at this moment. So I think we should just open for discussions. We have around 35 minutes for questions. I can see lots of people that work with intellectual property and communication and internet here in the room. So I think we take just some three questions and then answers and then three more questions and so on. Okay, one there. If you could please say your full name and where do you work at or what do you do? Is there tem microfone lá no fundo? Is there a microphone? Okay.
Thank you. My name is Pavel Antonov. I am a journalist covering environment, and I'm coordinating a initiative within the Association for Progressive Communications linking information technology and environment. So I have two questions. One is, in journalism, we don't speak too much about neutrality. We speak more about objectivity, and it's a slightly different meaning there. So I was wondering whether that association would make any sense in the context of the neutrality talk. And my second question, and I apologize in advance if it's absolutely relevant for most of you, but I would be curious to hear what you think, is whether an issue related to carbon neutrality and energy neutrality on the off the web would also fit into this context. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Second question.
Hello. My name is Andrea Glorioso from the Nexo Research Center of the Polytechnic of Torino, and I have a question for the lady from Google or from anybody else on the panel that wants to comment on that. And you've been correctly mentioning that one of the key issues of network neutrality is the access to information. However, on the current World Wide Web, it might be argued that a key for accessing information is finding that information. And I think it's no surprise to anybody in the room that Google is quite a big player in the game of finding information. You've also been talking about the incentives for network operators to create artificial scarcity, or in any case to alter what is happening on their pipes. Now my question is, isn't there exactly the same incentive for Google to alter the results of the searches or to facilitate or to favor certain players in the searches that are made on Google in order to get more money, for example, from those people? I'm not claiming that this is what you're doing at the moment. I'm making a more theoretical question. If we're speaking about neutrality, aren't there exactly the same incentives for Google or for any other company, any other profit-maximizing entity on the internet? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Andrea. Okay, we have a third question here in the front. I ask if there's another microphone, because it's not that clear to listen to. Tem outro microfone? Well, you can use this one, I guess.
Thank you. My name is Monica Avalo. I came from Argentina. I am a member of Argentina chapter of ISOC. And I have a question to related to legislation of Brazil. Because as far as I understand, Brazil has... do you want to change the mic?
Okay, let's keep on this one then.
As far as I know, Brazil has a okay. I try to finish my question. Has a law in relation with data protection. Is that right?
I can answer that. Actually, no. Data protection in Brazil is basically regulated by the civil code, the consumer code in Brazil. We do not have a specific law regulating data protection in Brazil. There has been discussions in the Mercosur level at creating one, but unlike Argentina, we do not have a comprehensive data protection regulation here.
Okay, and the second question is related to what is your meaning in terms of online ISPs? Is related to companies that give connectivity to internet, or are related to hosting content? What do you mean with that?
I use this terminology because that's the terminology actually used by the DMCA in the United States. So the Internet Service Provider stands for the provider of access. So it's the owner of the pipes that actually get your computer to the internet. The online service provider is actually providers who offer different services online. It can be, for instance, a hosting service. It can host your emails or files, or it can be a service like a social network, a search engine, and so it goes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, let's go for the answers, then we take more questions. So the first one, I think Marcelo Thompson will start answering, and if someone else would like to complement.
I think it's a good question, the issue of objectivity and neutrality, and to some extent it tackles what I try to address in my presentation. I guess when we speak about neutralities, we're speaking about pursuing or not pursuing particular conceptions of the good, about pursuing or not pursuing goals that we believe are valuable. When we are in a forum like this, when we are in the Internet Governance Forum, and we look at what we have achieved so far, we look at the values that we have so far agreed upon, values that we share, that we believe, that are charted in numerous instruments that we have agreed upon. If we look at the Tunis commitment, we will see many references to many different rights. We will see references to access, we will see reference to knowledge. We will see that it says that we should strive unremittingly to promote access to knowledge. And this is not the result of we arriving here excluding our value perceptions. This is the reflection of we arriving here and exposing our values, exposing the values that we believe, that we do share, and listen to the values that others share, and not to be neutral with regard to any values, but try to reach a consensus. And the question of objectivity is very interesting, because we see, for instance, when we look at the Wikipedia, we have there an issue which is the neutral point of view. The neutral point of view actually is similar to this discussion we're having here, whether it is of neutrality that we're speaking about, or whether it is about trying to reach consensus, though we share values, though we have our own conceptions of the good, and try to reach consensus on some standards of objectivity. And my point in raising this issue of neutrality is not that I disagree with any of the panelists. I do agree with all of them. I do agree with all of them because I do share the same values that they do share. I just think that the principle of neutrality is a very dangerous principle to be embedded in internet law and policy. Because if we're going to put into the law, we should research, we should look into neutrality in the sense that it has always meant in political theory and jurisprudence. And neutrality is actually a doctrine of exclusion of ideals. And I don't believe, I believe that we should pursue objectivity. I believe that in regulating the technological infrastructure, we should move from specificity to generality according to many different principles of laws, that we should protect some values, but I don't believe, and I don't think we should put in law that we should include in our laws a general commitment to neutrality.
Okay, thank you, Marcelo. Anyone else would like to say something? No? Okay. So the second question, I think, is for Johanna.
Thank you. Addressing the question of Google and the search engines and their role here, first let me clarify that we do not charge there's no money exchanged in any way for where somebody comes out in where a website comes out in a ranking on the Google search index. When people enter queries and want about a particular information in the search results that come up, there is no money exchanged for that. We would never charge for where a website would come out in that search. So let me just clarify that point. But we make no qualm about the fact that what we do want to do is index the entire web and go through and figure out all the content that's available on the web. People can choose to not have their content made part of our search engine, and there are ways for them to do that, and we respect that. But we do want to index the web, and we do want to make it available for people that want to find information on it. We started with a very mechanical algorithm, the PageRank, which became a fruitful exercise for people to try to find ways to artificially manipulate that to put something ahead of the rankings, not based on the fact that the users of the web themselves find it useful, but on the basis of some other criteria. And so we have taken steps to start addressing some of those artificialities that other people are injecting into the web and into the rankings of the search engine. But there are lots and lots of search engines. Obviously, we are at the information layer of the internet. There's lots of search engines. There's Yahoo, there's Live, there's Ask, there's Dogpile, there's a whole bunch of new ones coming online every day. There's smaller communities, personalization of search engines. So there really is, users are in control, and users are just a click away from going somewhere else to use a different search engine. If they find that Google doesn't satisfy their need, they can go elsewhere, and there is very few barriers and limits for them just being able to put in a different and use a different search engine. That is not the case with networks. There's quite a few barriers to changing your network provider. In the United States, there's particularly in the wireless space, there's a $200 charge on you if you try to break your two-year contract and go somewhere else. There's very few options and choices, particularly on the wireline side, for your ability to go elsewhere on the from the network infrastructure standpoint. We are very different from a transport in that sense. Our search engine ranking is, for the most part, based on the popularity of what users are doing on the web at any particular time. If the networks were also focused on what the users wanted to do, like the old telecommunications networks, where the user was in charge of what calling the phone call that they wanted to make, and there was no ability for the telephone network provider to interfere with that and to say, you really want to go somewhere else. I really want to, you know, maybe you should really go to this particular phone number instead of that particular phone number. It is the right to tell a particular user or other companies that they can't do what they want to do when they have paid for the capacity of that network. That is really problematic from our standpoint. Not you having the pipes influence what the user wants to do. And we at Google think that the user is the core focus of what we are doing any day.
Anyone else? No, okay. Okay, so let's go for the third set of questions. I see three hands. First back there, the Mr. in brown. Tem microfone para ele? Okay, here in the front.
Hello. We got you there too. Thanks for this opportunity. I've enjoyed this discussion. When I first heard the term net neutrality...
Sorry, could you just please introduce yourself?
Sorry, my name is Ian Peter. When I first became involved with any debate on net neutrality, it was over some very serious matters that were going on in the United States, where it would appear that certain telcos or access providers wished to turn the internet into something like a cable channel by providing specific access to the search engine will be who pays most, and the Facebook or YouTube will be whoever pays most, so that they would in fact set up a very, very different sort of network. And this was a serious issue, and this is where the new net neutrality came along. Since then, the debate has gone into many different channels, and it's become a little convoluted. And I do want to explain some of these convolutions and then ask the panel how we might be able to get through them. From there, it sort of became, well, we shouldn't be discriminating by types of traffic. And while I agree, certainly a carrier shouldn't stop BitTorrent, for instance, and shouldn't have any right to do that, I do believe in a thing called traffic shaping, which actually matters. I'd like my VoIP bits to get through because I need them instantly. I don't mind if my email bits arrive a few seconds later. So I don't see that as a neutrality issue. Others do. When we go on a little bit further, the debate that's been going on in the Internet Governance Caucus list is a spam filter a violation of net neutrality? And that has become a very heated debate, and it's become very much about, well, a filter, you know, might does filter on religious grounds, all sorts of things. So, in fact, the way that parameters apply to that. So what is happening, I think, is the debate's going further and further. I expect it'll hit encryption. I expect it'll hit password. I expect it'll hit NATs and network address translation and all sorts of other things. And we've gone a long way away from any useful definition and compelling thing that we actually need to do to chase the to shape the future of the internet. I'm wondering if the panelists have got opinions on this and how we might be able to. Do we need another term? How do we get this back to some of the central principles and the central things that we need to do to ensure the open and accessible internet? Thanks.
Okay, thank you. The second, I see João there.
Well, good afternoon. My name is João Branch. I'm from InterVozes, a civil society organization here in Brazil. And my question is very related to the previous one. As far as I could understand, Marcelo is against a proper regulation on the issue of net neutrality. Is that right? And actually, I want to ask you about what kind of regulation should be done to guarantee net neutrality. As far as I can see, regulation can hinder freedom, but can also guarantee freedom. Actually, the way internet is going on, if we don't have any kind of regulation, the jungle of the law will prevail, and the jungle of the law is not the law of the freedom. So I want to know the opinion about what kind of regulation should that be at an international level, or should that be at national level how to guarantee in a proper way the freedom at the internet.
Okay, thank you. And the third question here in the front, I think, was okay there in the middle.
Al Alegre from the Philippines, member of APC. One question is, well, first to link it back to human rights, and I don't know, some of these things should be what ISPs are doing and what the networks are doing should be in a context or environment of transparency. So I don't know what are the legal sort of basis for all of these things, so that these things are transparent to, for example, the traffic shaping or all of these things. So practical suggestions on what to advocate in terms of access to information of network providers and carriers, and et cetera. So we can move it forward in that sense. So, because if there's no transparency, then we don't know what they're doing to us. Yeah. Second, it's related actually to Ian's question about traffic shaping and what is legitimately. Well, it's clear that if you privilege content, for example, from an anti-competitive point of view, that's your competitor, and then you sort of slow down the traffic. That's very clear, no? If it's from transparent, but traffic shaping for small ISPs, we work with small ISPs who have limited resources, yeah? And we get into debates about how they should not sort of distinguish between the type of content that goes through their pipes, whether it's VOIP content or streaming video, et cetera, but they say that they should have the leeway. So maybe to Michael, what is the sort of line that is crossed between managing scarce resources, bandwidth, and being discriminatory with regards to what goes through your pipes?
Okay, thank you very much. So who from the panel would like to answer the first question?
Thanks. Well, actually, I think that all three questions were completely related. In fact, the answer to Ian came from the third questioner. With respect to transparency. I think that there are a number of things that can be done on the net neutrality side, and part of it is transparency. I think some of the stuff around traffic shaping and the like transparency doesn't solve it, but it certainly moves us much further from where we are today. So that I think that there needs to be, if the market isn't going to provide it, and network providers in terms of the way that they promoted many of their products, describing some things of unlimited, indeed often promoting the fact that you have the ability to download and share files in ever quicker fashion, yet at the same time shaping back the amount of bandwidth that you can actually use. To me, it's a classic, but then look at the fine print and you learn that they still may be on side with the relevant regulator, suggests that one of the things we need to do is make this far more transparent. It doesn't make traffic shaping go away, but at least allows people to better understand what it is they're buying and what some of the limitations in the system are. And the same might apply for spam filtering as well, in terms of making sure people are aware of what an ISP does or doesn't do, and allow people to turn that on or off if they like. The other thing that, of course, needs to happen is more competition, which is, you know, clearly obvious, but you know, if you have a choice of one or two high-speed providers as a residential customer, and both engage in traffic shaping, all the transparency in the world isn't going to help you, because you don't really have any other options. Those markets where there is far greater choice haven't seen some of these same kind of net neutrality concerns arise, because certainly a network provider is free to go ahead and engage in some of these activities. I can always walk across the street and go elsewhere, albeit there are some barriers to move between providers. In many communities today, there still isn't nearly enough competition to allow us to have that kind of choice. Then the next level, assuming that we're not going to have enough competition and then transparency doesn't get us all the way, is, I think, to start talking about what is the appropriate regulatory environment. And I think that while there are some things that are going to be controversial and probably remain so for some time, there are others that one would hope, I think, we could come to agreement fairly quickly. So blocking content, as an example, is one where I just don't see the basis upon which an ISP can, in a non-transparent fashion, block access to someone's content. You can certainly provide an individual consumer with filters and tools if they want to take it upon themselves to block access to content, but absent content that it is itself illegal to access, of which only child pornography, as far as I'm aware, at least in my jurisdiction, would apply, the notion of an ISP blocking anything that I have a right from a legal perspective to access, my perspective, ought to be a non-starter. If we started with those three things and then started moving into some of the more contentious issues, we'd at least clear away some of the differences in definition and move somewhere along the way towards a more open internet.
Hello. Okay. Just to comment on the Brazilian perspective about traffic shaping. The interesting thing is that traffic shaping in Brazil is dealt primarily from the perspective of consumer protection. Some of you might know, but the consumer movement in Brazil is very strong. It's probably maybe the strongest civil society movement here in the country. And it has made like very important achievements in the past 20 years. So basically, we do not have a law or a regulatory agency that oversees traffic shaping in Brazil right now. Even the Brazilian National Telecommunications Agency, it does not have jurisdiction over the so-called value-added services, so it doesn't really get to regulate this on a clear perspective. Of course, this jurisdiction is disputable, but as it is right now, probably it won't have jurisdiction to regulate traffic shaping. So what is going on is the consumer protection entities are gathering together and are launching, actually in the past two or three months, tests over the networks in different cities in Brazil to see if they can produce evidence for traffic shaping in Brazil. Because there has been reports primarily of two cases of traffic shaping. The first one is discrimination against the BitTorrent protocol. And the second one, and I think more important, is the discrimination over voice over IP services. So what is going on right now is that the consumer protection agencies and entities are getting together and are launching these tests in different cities of Brazil, and I believe the results will be published in the next 2 months or so. So that's it.
Okay, thank you. I think Marcelo has something to...
No, just a remark, because I was asked if I'm against network neutrality, and that's not exactly what I tried to convey in my speech. That no, 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 I'm not against. I think we should strive to regulate properly and to bring here a particular model of what I envision of a well-regulated internet. I think this would be a very complex issue to address in a single question. But with regard to network neutrality in particular, I fully share what was said in here. I don't agree with arbitrary traffic shaping. I don't agree with quality of service assurance that do not have reason to exist. But in some circumstances, it's certainly necessary to bring exceptions to a full-blooded end-to-end principle. We should have the end-to-end principle as an ideal of what made the internet be what the internet is today. But we do have to embed controls in the infrastructure of the net to some extent. And this actually happens. There was a discussion going on earlier on a panel on authentication technologies. the question of how we are going to build an identity layer for the internet. This is something that to some extent is already happening. We are already developing different kinds, different initiatives on identification. The net more and more turns to be a less anonymous space. And it's up to us the choices that we are going to make with regard to that. And the point is that we cannot believe that the main point of my speech is that we cannot believe that the technologies do not embed values. And we also cannot resist reflecting some values with regard to the technology. And this is the only extent in which I believe we should not speak of neutrality.
Okay, thank you, Marcelo. We are running out of time, so maybe one last question. Anyone? No? Three, two, okay. Okay, so Livia there. You have the microphone there in the middle? Okay, so first the gentleman.
Okay. My name's Tom Daly. I work for Verizon. It's been very interesting hearing the discussion. One question on economic incentives. Do you think, and this can be directed at any of the panelists, that from an economic standpoint, a network company is incented to expand its network more if it is relegated to the position of a dumb pipe, which I've heard suggested, or if it's able to compete vertically against companies like Google and the content providers and others?
Okay, thank you. And hello? Okay, thank you. And then the last question.
I don't know if I'm gonna help Marcelo or not, but I remember here in Brazil when we discussed public policies to enforce free software.
Sorry, could you introduce yourself first?
My name is Livia and I work at Brazilian government with digital inclusion. When we, some years ago, we started the discussion about enforcing free software in Brazil, technological neutrality was used as an argument against that, because people said that the state could not enforce a specific technology. And we had to explain that the option for free software is not a technological option only, but a choice about a specific kind of licensing, and the Brazilian government could do that without put away the principle of technological neutrality. So today when we discuss convergence, the expression technological neutrality is used every day. So I agree that you cannot have a regulation based on technology. You have to have a regulation based on services and not platforms. And the principle of technological neutrality helps me to say that. So I think we have to specify what we are talking about, because the idea of neutrality can be good or can be bad, and specifically about net neutrality, I think it's very useful to us. So that's it.
Okay, thank you. So now we have 3 minutes for the panelists to answer the first question.
I will start by answering the last one. Yes, it was extensively argued, and still is, because Brazil is still to some still pursuing free software policies, that we should not prioritize open source, that we should ensure equal competition against two kinds of different programs. And our defense to that, our argument in response to that, was that we can indeed make choices for a particular kind of contract, a particular kind of contract that fits more into the values we share, that fits better into the constitutional values that we have, that fits better with regard to the rights of privacy, rights to access of information, of governmental nature, many different rights that are framed within our constitution. And the issue of technological neutrality is, to me, something that we should understand better, as many times when we're talking about technological neutrality, we're not talking about neutrality, we're talking about generality. That laws should be framed in a general fashion, that laws should not try to achieve some ideas of sustainability and try to regulate functions and services, as you said very well, and not to try to portray what the technological infrastructure really is. But this, again, this is being general or not, and it's not being neutral.
Okay, thank you, Marcelo. I think Johanna will answer the first question, first and last question.
Sure. On the question of whether Verizon is able to compete vertically, the question is not, are they able to compete? I think the question is, are they competing fairly when they compete vertically? Are they enabling other people in the content application and service space to be able to make their content application services available to users, and then users decide on the basis of which idea or which content application or service they find the most to their liking and what they want to do with it. So it's a question of really not a question of heavy-handed regulation that has been in the past about tariffing and pricing regulation and some of those notions that I'm sure Verizon, with their familiarity with in the past, is very reticent to have apply here. We are not advocating that position. We are advocating treating similar services alike, treating the internet, respecting the free and open internet infrastructure, where you transport things in a neutral, non-discriminatory fashion without regard to the origin, the destination, who that particular user is, what that particular website is. You know, those kinds of a very specific and very discriminatory treatment, particularly when you have questions of whether people are also behaving in an anti-competitive fashion in that sense. We are very concerned about the two-tiered internet that was referenced earlier, that there's a public space and a proprietary space, and there's a toll road. And we pay right now, information companies pay billions of dollars to network operators to host the content and get the content to the internet space. And then the users can pay when they decide what kind of network they want in order to connect them to that space. And so there is a real concern about what happens in a world where there are payments applied and a toll applied, and what happens to the free and open internet. Does it atrophy in that situation? What are the effects there? So I think we very much don't have a problem with vertical competition. It's a question of how one is competing. Are the principles of the free and open internet, user choice, innovation, going to continue to remain the founding principles as we go forward? Are we encouraging the further evolution of the content applications and services layer, or are we going to put barriers and require permissions before people can do what they want to do? Applications should reach everyone. The users should be free to decide where they want to go, what they want to do, and let's all compete on ideas, and let's compete on what we can bring to users in this really incredibly powerful medium.
Okay, so I think that's it. I thank you all the panelists, and that's it. Thank you.